Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organizational studies, brought to you with the support of the School of Business, Management, and Economics at the University of Sussex. This is episode 39, where we are discussing Cohen, March, and Olson's 1972 article, A Garbage Can Model of Organizational Choice. To get the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. So in this part of the podcast, we're going to talk about the themes that we get or we interpreted in the article and how we think that relates to other research going on in organizational and management studies.
Well, I have a general question. And I think the first question we can ask is, and we touched upon that in a previous part, is how common are these anarchic situations, organizations, as part of normal organizational life? I think today we have a more kind of an understanding of how much lack of shared goals or uncertainty and so on and so forth is part of normal organizational life of large manufacturing companies or hospitals or, you know, professional service firms, you know. So we understand this as part of the fabric of organization dynamics. So what can we think of the dynamics described in the paper for this?
I had that thought also. And I think, generally speaking, it's quite difficult for me, at least, to see an organization which purely works like that, like it's been modeled in the article. But what I'm more... keen on, and what I'm going to throw in the arena, is that possibly there are specific situations or parts of the an organization that does have general overarching clear goals, but in reality can behave like this. I mean, that's my interpretation. I'm not sure.
I think that's a good point, Miranda. I think so. There are probably not many organizations that are purely anarchic. Universities
but
may come close.
Quite fair. We're picking on universities, not to pick on them, but because they're the example that's been provided by the article.
Right.
There is always an overarching general mission or set of values. And I think even if there isn't, at least today and in recent years, management has acknowledge the importance of an overarching goal, mission, value, whatever you want to call it, and has been pushing organizations to reach that kind of standpoint. So
I want to play devil's advocate. And
I love it when you do that because you're a very good devil.
Oh, thank you. Wonderful. I'll save that compliment. Because I actually think that, yes, there are usually efforts to document or force or even generate, if you want to talk about, a common shared goal. But actually, there's also a lot of ambiguous goals, unclear, competing. You know, I understand that you might say that, you know, universities or professional service firms try to create an overarching goal, but at the same time, just by the nature of organizations in which you have so much specialization, you have different departments doing different things, you're always going to have some kind of ambiguity, some localized goals, some kind of, you know, competing things.
Yeah, but it's different because there is the effort and there's the acknowledgement of reality. There's kind of like the acknowledgement of reality, full stop. There is no effort in solving the goal ambiguity, which starts off as an assumption and it's a definition. So if we go to universities, depending on what is going on, it could be that because, I don't know, a ref is coming out or a TEF is coming out, that within the goal ambiguity, some aspects in a certain specific time frame become more important.
But I guess we are going to talk about that in more in the next episode, in which we talk about images of organization and different ideas. But I think it depends where you sit in different ideas of organizations. You know, if you think in a more top-down way, yes, you can see there is always an overarching goal. But some people would say that no, actually, we should not even think of organization in such terms because it's all depends on the politics. And some groups are going to impose some goals on others, but it's a series of factions try to, you know, push for one idea over the other, and some win, what is a fruit of politics, not of just managerial well-doing. So I think it depends where you want to see, how you want to see organizations.
I suppose it depends how you see it, if it's half full or half empty. But still, there's, even if you talk about politics, there are moments in which, even if it's a brief moment, there will be one set. I really struggle in seeing these organizations completely lost in the middle of nowhere.
But that, I think that's my point. I think you assume that you must have a goal, otherwise you're lost. And I'm saying that maybe there is heterogeneity and actually it's normal in organizing, and organizations can function very well like that. So you see what I'm trying to push.
I think you're both right in some ways, right? I think Miranda is right to say there's probably no organization that's purely anarchic, that it's always like this, or basically, as she was saying, you have these conflicting goals and then full stop. And then, Pedro, I think you're right in that some parts of the organization may move in and out of anarchic situations from time to time. I think you're agreeing with Miranda that there probably is no full embodiment of this kind of an organization. And I think that's part of what is in the paper is that, they create the model and they just kind of stopped, like Miranda said. And I think that each of you has a really good point about, a lot of organizations are really trying to, and I don't think any organization could function as a pure anarchy like they're talking about, right? I think Miranda's point, if I'm getting it correctly, is that, hey, a university can't function that way. You really couldn't have something that we recognize as a university if it was always anarchic. And so there's a lot of times when they are able to align over really important things from time to time. And I think that the model doesn't rule that out. It's just a little depressing the way they look at it. Am I summarizing that correctly, Miranda?
I think this is kind of like basically a critique that we can move towards the model, which it's basically it's pure spirit.
Yes.
So it's talking, it's modeling things, it's simplifying
yes,
things.
Yes, absolutely.
Because all of us are used to doing research and looking at the world in a different way. Obviously, this is something which strikes us as important to talk about and to open up. But if you look, there are so many things that we've mentioned in the discussion before that are not taken into consideration by the model,
yes.
Whether it be past routines, history, time frames, a general overarching mission that's in the background but it's ignored, the environment even. It's something that we haven't really – it's not part of the model.
No.
And it's not – purpose of the model either.
Right. And I think that's, as you pointed out, it's the model is simplified. And so I personally get a bit frustrated with what looked like overly simplistic models. So originally when I was reading the article and I'm wading through all that math and the matrices and the definitions, I'm thinking, how is this going to produce something useful when you're going to this kind of level of detail? And then I see later, all right, well, they're just trying to make some generalizations about this kind of decision-making process and this what happens when you have these conflicts. But as a researcher, I'm always interested in, oh, let's go look at some cases. Let's go see how this works, because what I felt was lacking from the model is this whole aspect, which I think Miranda is touching on, and that is agency. You know, the fact that there's actually people inside actively working to reduce this ambiguity. And in fact, that makes a big difference, I think. And many streams of research talk about that, about the role the leader plays and how the entrepreneur, I mean, Miranda was talking about that earlier, where an entrepreneur, does he, you know, create a new need or does he respond to a need that's already existing? You know, those kinds of things. Well, I think the agency is very important there.
Well, let me throw in a further idea with that, because, you know, when I look at the structures in which they put, the matrices that they put in the text, I kind of saw not just three different methods of access, three different decision structures, but I almost saw a sequence. And kind of bear me out. Like, look at the access structure. When you think about a new organization, and I've been in a few new organizations, I'm sure you all have, seen them too.
I have, yes.
Doesn't a new organization look like unsegmented access and unsegmented decision making? Especially if it starts with a small cohort of folks who are just basically all thrown together or who volunteer to come together. Every problem, every choice, everything looks equal. There's so much to do. There's no time to think about it. You don't have processes in place. There's a lot that has the feel, you know, those structures. I'm not so sure that the energy distribution quite matches that, but the access and the decision structures at zero look like new organizations. Then you move to the hierarchical access and the hierarchical decision making. And I kind of think that as organizations grow, you start to see this, where now that you're past the newness, you're starting to think about problems and choices. Okay, who's the one who has the authority to make decisions? And you start to see it getting more stratified, especially as the organization grows and it starts to build its bureaucratic structure. And so you kind of move from zero to one. And then what happens when it goes all the way to what John Cotter in his book Accelerate described as complete ossification? It looks like two. The specialized access, where now everything is so siloed. You have very specific individuals who handle very specific problems. I look at number two and I'm thinking there's no cross communication.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it.
Okay. Now, as we think about this and we think about actual organizational behaviors, obviously these do not represent fixed states. I mean, what you're talking about in terms of, well, organizations are not always anarchic. I think that there's a natural tendency for them to sort of shift to some hybrid in between these three states. Whereas under certain circumstances, then of course the organization is going to get into a rut. In other circumstances, when it's in crisis, then it's going to move back to something a little bit more unsegmented in order to, I'm generalizing really badly here, but, it's going to move to a different state to try to resolve the problem, then get back to, where it was. I also kind of think that, access and decision structure zero sort of represent low entropy. I mean, that's basically when everybody is involved equally, and you have a system that basically maximizes the ability to translate inputs to outputs, or however, whatever metaphor you want to use. Whereas by the time that you get to access two, entropy has gone to the point where the system is just not really working very well. If a problem or a solution doesn't come in that exactly fits the model of the organization, it breaks the organization. Again, oversimplifying, but you kind of see how that is the sort of a model in which they're describing. So I think there is some elegance to the way in which they drew this. They may not have intended it that way, but that's just what struck my mind as I was thinking through the organizations that I helped stand up in the past or were participating in standing up in the past, or in organizations that have been around so long that you wonder if maybe they should go away or something. You know what I mean?
I haven't thought in the progression that you're describing. I think it's very interesting and just made me rethink about the article. But I just disagree that it's so clear-cut, and I know you know that as well. You're just trying to make an argument, because being someone that studies bureaucracy, I feel that actually when you have a clear specialized system, it can actually be generative and enabling, because assuming that you have the capacity of matching well decisions and problems, this can also be done in collective ways. We can have joint reviews in which you go through problems and you assign people, not just because you're the only people that can solve that, but because having one person solving sometimes, is more efficient, effective, and so on and so forth. So there's some possible blending in the way specialization can happen, for instance.
Yeah, I think you're both right, because you think about some of these lower importance, lower difficulty problems. Yes, you would expect organizations to resolve those fairly quickly and also refer those to specialists, because they have the expertise to address those kinds of problems. So I think some of your frustration is similar to what Miranda talks about, where they looked at this, maybe negative isn't the best way to describe it, but an organization that doesn't function the way we classically see them, which leaves out all that that idea of matching the organization to the problems it faces and how things change over time. And I just think that's a limitation of the model. If you're going to take the people out and you're going to say, well, here's how these processes function, irrespective of the choice of decision makers, or we're going to put in some random series of problems, then there's a limitation to how much you can draw out of the model's implications as a result. So Miranda, I was curious, you were talking earlier about the research you've done in entrepreneurial activity and leadership and such. Do you think how does that research stream bounce off or connect to or go in a different direction from what you see here?
Well, that's an interesting question that I haven't got a straightforward answer to. But I don't know, that there's definitely this difference that I already highlighted in terms of terminology. So if in entrepreneurship we talk about opportunities, here we talk about problems, even though if you look at social entrepreneurs, they start off from the idea that there is a problem, a societal problem that could be solved. So that's one starting point. But at the same time, it's always seeing these problems as opportunities. But generally speaking, it's completely the reverse in entrepreneurship, in the sense that businesses exist because there was the exploitation of an opportunity of something to be solved. So that's one starting point. So I think I generally struggle in seeing this in the field of entrepreneurship.
Just to making a link with, you know, the previous episode on the Carnegie Mellon, you know, and you said exploitation, but maybe we can think about the difference in terms of exploration and exploitation, because entrepreneurs are probably, I know you said exploitation, but it's probably, you know, in the lingo of the Carnegie Mellon would be exploration, so creating new opportunities, as you say, whereas here, in the way organizations are described, is more about exploitation, you know. So problems are because you simply have to keep doing the things and do as much efficient and effective as you can, and there's something that, you know, is generating uncertainty and it's creating problems in that way.
Okay, yeah, that's a good point. So there's definitely this difficulty in terms of terminology used. I think some sort of application of the garbage can model could be seen in the case of businesses when, for some reason, they still have a certain technology or processes or way of doing things, but they, for some reason, for market reasons, they need to apply it to something else, or they want to, I don't know, extend the product line or try to grow their businesses and try to get over the downsides of the business cycle. So that could be one way of stretching it into the world of businesses. Generally, I think there is definitely the contrast between this assumption of organized anarchies and some sort of clarity, even if it's just an overarching goal of the business per se. So possibly a garbage can model can be applied not to the entire business, but to sections of the business or specific time frames or specific decisions that need to be taken, but not the general business. I think that could be one way of finding a compromise, at least.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it. And I think, you know, when Tom was talking about the sort of the startup mode of businesses being similar to the unsegmented access, where he was looking at how businesses change over time, I think that's also, you know, connects to entrepreneurial research, where at the beginning it tends to be kind of messy from an organizational point of view when they're trying to figure out how to explore this new idea and then transition to exploitation, I'm thinking.
Yeah, we also talk a lot about garbage can model in strategic decision making from a political standpoint. And that sort of alludes to what I was talking about before, with solutions out there looking for a problem to solve. And in a lot of cases, because of the short-term nature of public sector issues, a lot of times that's exactly what happens, is that you have a problem to solve. You're looking for what's out there already, or you don't know that you have a problem and the solution avails itself, and it's like, oh yeah, we can do something with this. do something right now, and we can perhaps perceive a benefit. And this is perhaps where the energy distribution aspect of the model comes into play. Obviously, organizational energy in public sector organizations is something that's very important, because demands on one's energy vastly exceed anyone's capacity. I mean, there are so many things out there that public sector officials have to deal with, and so it's a matter of trying to deal with the what can I do in the short term that can make a difference and allow me the freedom to be able to do other things that are on my agenda. So we definitely make use of this, of the ideas behind the model when discussing decision making at a government level.
Yeah. So one of the things I was thinking about when the article was first talking about having solutions in search of problems, right? There's kind of a pejorative sense to that, saying, okay, well, you just have, you know, if your favorite tool is a hammer, then every problem looks like a nail. And so there's that aspect where you're not being very creative and you're just trying to do the same stuff over and over. But as Tom was talking about strategic decision making and strategy formulation or policy formulation, one thing that occurred to me was, you know, large organizations, they're not infinitely customizable. I mean, this may be a difference with entrepreneurial organizations, but large organizations have a few standard ways they go about solving problems, which people recognize, they know how to do, they know how to function. And the analogy might be, you know, UN peacekeeping, right? The UN knows how to do that, and the member organizations know how to participate, and there's an existing protocol for that. So that you could make the argument that sometimes we put peacekeepers in situations where they're not well-suited or it's not a good problem for them to be working on. But the reality is, and whether it's an anarchic situation or not, large organizations don't have unlimited energy, like Tom was talking about, particularly amongst the senior decision makers. So it seems to me one of the implications for this kind of research is how does that work when you decide, okay, we're going to take this tool that we know how to use and we're going to go put that in a place versus, well, I'm going to try to design some sort of custom organization or custom solution to this kind of a problem when – As Tom was pointing out, you don't have unlimited sources of energy for these kinds of things. And I used to tell people, a good example is on aircraft carriers, right? You have a crew of about 2,600 people. And then when you bring the air wing on and you're actually overseas doing the work that aircraft carriers do in a wartime environment, you have probably a total 4,400, 4,200 people when you add the pilots and the maintenance crews and the logistics personnel and that sort of thing. And so people would come to me and say, "Well, here's this great, excellent, you know, well-designed plan, you know, that we could go do." And I would tell them, "I can't execute that. I mean, it sounds like a good plan, but I can't execute that." And so my rejoinder would often be, "Look, a weak to mediocre plan." This goes a little down that dark side Miranda was trying to keep us out of, but a weak to mediocre plan, well executed, is always better than a fabulous, you know, plan poorly executed. And I think sometimes organizations have to make trade-offs like that.
Okay, let me make it even worse for you, because because, you know, to this point, what have we been talking about in terms of a decision? Has it been to apply some sort of means to a problem that's presented? When we talk about decisions in the political environment, we're essentially talking about decisions to decide. And that adds a further dimension to what we mean by decision, because now when you say use the UN peacekeeping example, think of, you know, there's the decision to employ. But there's like a thousand – well, not a thousand. I'm exaggerating. But there's a bunch of preceding decisions, of which some of those are decisions whether or not to acknowledge the existence of the problem. And that's where the garbage can model comes in very handy, because the solutions don't necessarily look like means. They look like choices to defer, choices to act immediately, choices to act unilaterally, choices to use a different mechanism. And so then there's a sequencing aspect, of which certain decisions take far more energy than others, and that can get very complicated.
I was going to maybe point out a more bright side, because as...
Oh, come on. I have another dark side.
No, because as Ralph was... No, because I think Ralph draw like made me aware of something. It was in the back of my mind, which is how having solutions ready for problems can actually be very enabling. So again, we can have a link here to what has been discussed by the Carnegie Mellon tradition in terms of routines. And we talked about that in episode 4, which is, you know, routines are standardized, ready to wear, ready to apply kind of solutions. And as Ralph was saying, exactly, large organizations are not, cannot recreate, reuse, redo everything. And having these routines is actually can be very positive. You know, the research I have done in complex organizations, I have seen that when you have a specific way of handling a type of problems and you find a related one, if you have a routine in place, which might be a meeting through which you review problems or a way in which you do problem solving and brainstorming, or any other thing, you know, how the way you allocate tasks, blah, 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 can actually give you, you know, a place to start. And this way you are not overwhelmed by a problem, but you already have something, you know, in your toolkit, so to speak. And actually people that study innovation and open innovation actually say that many times there are interesting surprises in ways that certain problems find ways of dealing with them that we never thought about that. You know, so there is room for bricolage, in which we thought that necessarily would require something specific, tailored made, but actually you apply something from a different realm and it works very well. So there is this positive side of having your toolkit ready of solutions.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of research done about, you know, for organizations, they see this problem, they apply a known solution or something they know how to do, but then they make adjustments as they go, so that all the you're not spending forever in some kind of design process, because in whether it's universities or military or strategic policy formulation, one of the worst things you can do is have problems or choice opportunities multiply without doing anything, because then you have what is sometimes referred to as analysis by paralysis. So that's also a rational response to these difficult problems is, okay, let's just go do something and make adjustments as we go.
And in a way, you can read the article almost as a blessing to saying, like, that happens, that's normal, and, you know, it's actually valid.
No, I just wanted to bring up this idea of solutions looking for problems. The first time I came across it, I immediately thought about the discourse around consumerism. So the idea, and I'm not an expert in the field, on which marketing as a field has been established, that businesses were at a point in time where they try to induce needs. And I think that is quite fitting as a mechanism to be able to see this model in reality.
Yeah, that's a good approach. And we know that from our listener feedback that we do have people out there who are in marketing. So if you want to give us some feedback about how you think this applies, that would be helpful. And we might include that in a newsletter. And that's all for part 2 of episode 39. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the discussion and found it valuable. If so, please tell your friends, colleagues, and students who may be interested in these topics about the podcast. You can also give us feedback, which we love to receive, via Twitter, Facebook, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com, which is where you can also subscribe to our newsletter. Please join us next time as we conclude our discussion of Cohen, March, and Olson's 1972 article, A Garbage Can Model of Organizational Choice, here on Talking About Organizations,